How's it going? How you been?
Let's get started.
What's scrapping?
Yo, yo.
Tuned in to Aljo the Funk Master. Watch your grill, yoga, knock that cold fast. And talking shit, now we talking facts. Where the mountain off the back, you in trouble, came to burst your bubble. I don't shelter punches, they find home on your mind about a double. This the weekly scraps. You don't need a map, GPS, I'm right here to lead a dash. The world doesn't know it needs, but I grow disease. Planet, fuck a name and a fame. Only legacy remains. Remember the name, Aljamain.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to the weekly scraps. Oh man, coronavirus. I got my roommate, plural, hanging out in the room right now, quarantining himself. He's really taking this to the extreme levels of safety precautions. I don't know if I can blame him, but it is kind of weird being that we can't infect each other. We are asymptomatic if we do come in contact with the virus, at least so I've been told. So at this point, if I have it, I have it. I'm not in contact with any elderly people, so I feel comfortable hanging amongst people. I'm not in any big, extremely big gathering groups of people, so I don't really feel like it's affecting me or my immediate ones as would some other people who are hanging out with their grandparents and things like that. So I don't really understand this whole virus thing in terms of the coronavirus is a thing of the past, but the COVID, whatever, 19 is a different strand of the virus. So I get that. And for some reason, we can't seem to, the elderly people have a harder time fighting it. So they're more at risk and potentially becoming ill and potentially dying. I know what I feel. I feel this thing is population control. That's just my opinion. I could be completely wrong and just talking shit. But we've seen this time and time again talking about, I think it was Steve Jobs or Bill Gates. One of the two. On YouTube, there's a video and they're talking about how to reduce the use of natural resources and things like that. And they were talking about population control and they were saying through means of healthcare and viruses, things like that. So this could be one of those things. I'm not big into conspiracies, but this is a big conspiracy in my viewpoint where I sit. But I just don't see how you can have a virus that doesn't really affect kids and children, young infants, as it does for elderly people. I think the elderly people started to hit up the government like, hey, my Social Security and Medicare benefits, I want to tap into that. And the government's probably like, you know what? All you motherfuckers can't do this all at once. So we got something for your asses. We're going to inject these bats. We're going to have these people who eat these bats. We're going to come up with some crazy thing and say people ate the bats and now they're sick. And they're going to bring it and spread it all across the fucking world and cause a implosion upon itself. But again, I'm not into conspiracy theories, but I'm just saying it's a thought. I mean, I have heard crazier things, right? So I don't know. I guess the best thing that people have been saying has been to quarantine yourself for 2 weeks. Like I said, my roommate has taken this to extreme. He's literally in his room as we speak. Doors locked. Doesn't come out unless he needs to use the bathroom. But he did engage in some extracurricular activities with us. So I'm like, dude, if we had it, you've got it at this point, you know? So I think you could hang out. Hey, go back in your room. Go back in your room.
All
of this. Go back in your room.
Conspiracy theory, you maniac. All right, don't breathe on my door.
Oh, he's back in the room. He's back in the box. We got the Lysol and Febreze, and it kills COVID-19, I've been told. So you're safe. You are safe. But other than that, things are business as usual. Back doing PT at this new place. Well, it's not a new place. I've been here before, but I'm back doing this. We actually did a nice lift this morning, full body workout. And I felt like complete shit in terms of muscle fatigue. We did a lot of legs, and my legs felt like shit. I mean, I've been doing a lot of upper body stuff, working on my back muscles out with the UFC PI team in Vegas. So coming back, I kind of flip-flopped it now. Now my legs are like, bro, you haven't used this in so long. What are you doing to me? No. But hopefully we get that back on track tomorrow. We're going to work upper body. So we're going to be hitting in like 4 or 5 days a week. There's a lot of weightless stuff. So body weight stuff and a lot of lightweight things. Very, very challenging, but it was fun, good, different. And like I said, it got the muscles firing and I felt good just getting back in the mix of things and doing a little bit of cardio. And that's the main thing. So I want to keep my cardio somewhat sharp just in case I do get that fight in San Diego, May 16th. I can't really break news on that because it's not really news. It's just a potential chance for me to fight on that card. Hopefully we can get it done and get my wrist back into action so that we can fight in beautiful San Diego, California. Still waiting to see how things progress and go from there. If not, then I'm definitely eyeing that June 27th card in Austin, Texas. But we'll see. We'll see with everything happening, cards being canceled, Khabib and Ferguson must go on, as Dana White said, even if it's in another country with no fans whatsoever. My roommate did give me a great analogy from one of our other teammates saying, I guess the way he said, I don't want to butcher it, but it was hilarious the way he said it. I was trying to get him on a podcast so that he could do it, but he wants to quarantine himself. So again, he's in his room, but he said something along of lines like, these are the best guys. It's like, Khabib is unstoppable and it's like Ferguson's unbeatable and it's like the opposite forces. They're like magnets and they just won't, polar opposites. They're the same. So they just won't collide and have that battle. And it's like the universe just doesn't want it to happen. And we need this to happen. I need to find out. And I think we all need to find out who is the better or the best lightweight of all time. Between these two guys, undefeated Khabib. I think he's 28 or 29-0. Either one, still super impressive. And Tony Ferguson on a 12-fight win streak, just finishing guys left and right, slicing them up left and right. And we need to find out who's the fucking best. Tony Ferguson never lost his interim title. So technically, this fight should have happened a while ago. He should never have been stripped. And it is what it is. Time and time again, the forces of the universe just won't allow this fight to happen. 2 times for Tony pulling out, 2 times for Ferguson. That's the same people. 2 times for Tony pulling out and 2 times for Khabib pulling out. And we think 5th time's a charm and hopefully we can make this happen. And we saw the ESPN and Tony Ferguson, the ESPN clip that Tony Ferguson posted of him training in jeans and a belt on. And Khabib Nurmagomedov, I'm not even going to say his last name, just Khabib. Khabib comments saying, like, who trains in belts and jeans? It's like, what kind of training is that? But it's hilarious because it's Tony Ferguson style training. It's whatever he thinks is going to improve or whatever he feels like training. If he's in a suit and he feels like doing push-ups, he might just drop right there, keep the blazer on and just do his push-ups right there, just like that. He's that type of a guy. Tony Ferguson is the type of guy to work out in a full-on suit. Tony Ferguson is the type of guy who makes water work out. You know, he's that type of dude. He just does things very, very differently. But we did have our recap of UFC Brasilia, the first event with no fans. The UFC decided the show must go on, and it did. And I thought it was pretty cool. You can hear the breathing. You can hear the elbows. You can hear the kicks. You can hear everything a lot more with impact and it just more definitive as opposed to the crowd noise drowning things out and the talking and things like that. So I found it to be a little bit more intimate. It's like almost like you go into the backyard and you have that brawl, or not even a brawl, the bang out session between, bang out sounds a little bit weird, so I'm going to say it different, a scrap between two people in the backyard with just a select group of people, and it's only you guys. There's no real ref to really break it up. It's just you guys kind of having at it, and someone's gotta break, something's gotta give, that type of thing. I guess that's kind of what it feels like, if the best way I could kind of put it into any type of analogy. So I felt it was a little bit more intimate, as opposed to having a crowd there and everyone watching. You kind of feel like you get a little bit of that extra motivation, like, nah, I ain't no bitch, I ain't gonna back down. But when no one's watching, I think it's a little easier to be like, you know what? I can kind of fold, because it's not like there's a ton of people watching. Even though there are millions of people watching back home, I think in the feel of the environment, I don't think you notice the cameras that are on you in the moment of the fight. At least I don't. But just starting with the main event, Kevin Lee versus Charles Oliveira. This was a great fight. The only thing that really disturbed me is I legitimately starting to believe that there is a such thing as a 3-round Kevin Lee and a 5-round Kevin Lee. 5-round Kevin Lee always seems to gas out after the first or second round, and it's always extremely evident on his face and his body language. And for a guy as talented as Lee, it's super frustrating as a fan of the sport. I'm a fan of just about every single fighter. I find that you could take inspiration and skill set from everybody. I think everyone does things a little bit differently for the most part. So my frustration lies where, as a guy is that talented, how does he always allow himself to come up to these big marquee fights with either like a huge pimple on his chest with like staph infection or missing weight or gassing himself out early? The only time I think he did not gas out to the point where he was able to get capitalized on was Edson Barboza, and that was in Atlanta City when I fought Brett Johns. Other than that, you've seen his fights with Aya Quinta, you see his fight with Tony Ferguson, you see his fight now with Charles Oliveira. I'm not sure if there was another one that he had that was a 5-rounder, but Rafael Dos Anjos, he just seems to gas out after the very first 5 minutes. And I don't know if he's hyping himself up and he's doing himself a disservice like that in the back room. Maybe it's an overly hard warm up. Maybe it was the weight cut. Maybe he did have another staph infection on his chest. There's just so many variables going into it. Maybe he overtrained. There is a such thing as overtraining, in my opinion. And I think there's a lot of factors going into this. And I think Lee at this point needs to do a little bit of soul searching and figure out what he really wants with the remainder of his career in the sport, or if he's just going to fight to fight, or if he's going to actually try to make another run at UFC Gold. He's in a shark tank of a division as it is. So your mind, you have to be mentally prepared to go through those gauntlets of fights with these guys who on any given day could be UFC champions. And I'm just not seeing that out of him of late. Obviously, he had that spectacular win over a guy like Gregor Gillespie, who is undersized for 155, who is not as well decorated and accomplished in terms of name value and marquee fights as a guy like a Charles Dubronx, who's fought a Cub Swanson, he's fought a Frankie Edgar, he's fought Jim Miller twice, he's fought tons of guys, and on a 7-fight win streak, 7-fight finishing streak as well to accompany that. So I look at that, and it's like I said, it's super tough to figure out where he really stands and what he wants to do. At the end of the day, ultimately, it's up to him. He's made so much money at this point in his career, his young career. I believe he's only 26, maybe 27 years old. Has a house, has a car. I would imagine has a pretty sizable savings account, being that he lives in Las Vegas. I live in New York, so taxes work a lot differently over here. And if you check my other episodes, I did give a little briefing on that. And I'm going to actually touch on that maybe later with this, but we'll see if time permits. So I think he's all right. He's set. He's chilling. He doesn't need to fight anymore at this point, but he could. It all depends on what his motivation is, his drive when he gets in there. So just breaking down the fight, I thought it was a very back and forth fight. The first round was back and forth until Kevin Lee got the takedown. Super close round. Oliveira landing more of the damage and strikes. Lee looking like he's pushing his punches early in that first round. Doesn't look like he has a snap on it like a traditional boxer or kickboxer. It just looks awkward when he's in a when he's throwing hands. He hits hard. I think he has very flexible legs where he throws those kicks and he whips them up out of nowhere. I think that's more of his game, kicking and grinding with the wrestling and ground and pound. In the first round, he landed some big bombs where, in my opinion, I was like, dude, if you land a couple more of those, this fight's fucking over. Charles Oliveira is known to cheese doodle out of the fight, find a way out in the past. But of late, he's done a lot better in terms of staying in the fight, hanging in there when it's getting tough, weathering the early storm. I think the last time he lost was to Paul Felder. And he attacked. It looked like he just fatigued himself and found a way to get out of there against Paul Felder. And Felder just poured it on and finished the fight. So with that being said, Oliveira, like I said, looks like a newly reinvigorated man of late. 7-fight finishing streak in a shark tank of a division. Beat the number 8 ranked Kevin Lee. Or 6. I can't remember exactly what he was ranked coming into this one. 6 or 8. But Oliveira was ranked, I think, right outside of that top 10. For him to get a finish over him like that. Definitely going to see a big shakeup in the UFC lightweight division. The other thing, that second round, Lee was doing some good stuff. Landing some good takedowns. Again, looked like he was pushing his punches. Weathering the storm. It looked like he got the takedown. He was just trying to rest. Defended a armbar, defended a triangle choke. And I'm like, this guy puts himself in these bad positions, even though they're great positions. He's in great position, but then puts himself in a bad position where it's just frustrating. Because as a guy who's as powerful and as strong as a wrestler as Kevin Lee is, it's like, dude, how have you not learned from your mistakes in the past as of yet? And again, I'm wondering if it's a mental lapse. Is it a conditioning thing? Is it an overtraining thing? Or maybe it's truly just a skill thing. Maybe he is just talking more than how good he really is, which is tough to even say that because it's like the guys that he's beaten, Jake Matthews, Francis Trinaldo, I forgot that other Russian fighter he fought. He submitted him. All these guys, rear naked choke submissions, finishing these guys. Going the distance with Ian Quinta twice. Doing what he did to Tony Ferguson before Tony Ferguson finished him. So it's like, the skill set is there, but maybe the mental approach or being able to weather those tough storms is not there. But then against Edson Barboza, we see him get wheel kicked, where most guys would have been like, all right, I'm done. I'm out. I'm gone. After winning the fight and dominating, but he managed to hang on and get another takedown and continue the onslaught beating that he was putting on Edson Barboza. So that's kind of where I'm at with a guy like Kevin Lee. He needs to reevaluate what he wants and what's important to him. And again, like I said, if it's not money, if it's not UFC gold, I don't know what it is. You got to figure it out in terms of what you want, because this is a sport that is super unforgiving and is what have you done for me lately? And if you go out losing on a streaks like that after reaching the pinnacle of the sport where you did get the challenge for UFC gold, I think the fans easily forget how good you really were and your accomplishments leading up to that. They only remember the stuff that weren't good. It's like whenever things are going good between you and your girlfriend, you only kind of harp on the bad. For the most part, most of us, I think that's a natural thing. We forget to sing the praises of good that happens in our relationship. But the bad tends to stick out more than the good. Even though the good stuff are great, we just don't really talk about it. It's like the good things in the world. What does the social media do? What does the media on TV do? It talks about the bad shit going on in the world as opposed to the kids that are doing really good in their schooling and shit like that, you know? So that's just a natural thing. People are going to only remember the bad stuff about Kevin Lee. Oh, he lost to this guy. Oh, but he lost to this guy. Oh, he sucks. But does he really suck? No, I don't think so. I just think it's a little shift that he needs to make. And maybe things could change for him in the second stint of his career. I don't know. Like I said, it really depends on what he wants for this. But Charles Oliveira, man, triangle choke, submission attempt after submission attempt, walking Kevin Lee down, stepping in with those knees, trying to hit those elbows, throwing those punching combinations. His striking looked crisp. His submission attempts, sharp, keeping you on your toes the entire time, has you defending the entire time, even off of his back. Almost had the armbar, almost had the... The the triangle choke transition off of the failed armbar. And again, like I said, just a beautiful submission artist. And he just attacks. And then Kevin Lee shoots him one more time that third round, 28 seconds in, gets his neck snatched up. Beautiful high elbow guillotine by Oliveira. And you can see that Kevin tries, as he's going down, he's trying to get his arm over the top shoulder. That's how you defend that choke. Get your arm over the shoulder and you can defend it, take away the pressure. Otherwise, if that elbow goes over your shoulder, you're going to almost essentially hang yourself, because obviously the person is doing the choke, he's doing the hanging. But with your arm being passed by that forearm and elbow, it's really hard. The only way to get out at that point is to roll through. And Oliveira did a beautiful job locking down with that scorpion. It wasn't a full-on scorpion, but it was a half-guard lockdown that kept Kevin Lee from rolling through. And he was able to secure the choke. Kevin Lee starts tapping really quickly. And then after the refs jumps in, he's holding on. Looks like he's trying to take the back. And I'm just like, bro, do not pull a Chael Sonnen right now. Dude, don't you dare pull a Chael Sonnen right now. This fight's fucking over. You fucking tapped. It is what it is. And yeah, Masvidal actually had a fair share of words for that. And for Kevin Lee, not nice. But I don't know if they had like some back and forth banter in the past or something, maybe. But Masvidal definitely attacked that ass right away. No rest for the wicked. Co-main event, Damian Maia versus Gilbert Burns. Burns looking phenomenal as of late, coming up to 170. I believe he's now 4-0 in the welterweight division, taking on Damian Maia, who's ranked, I think, 5 at welterweight. And for Burns to come up in just 4 fights, take out a guy like Damian Maia, who people know once the fight hits the ground, it's usually not a good night for you. Every time the fight did hit the ground, Burns had an answer. Goes attacking leg lock attempts, attacking a knee bar on Damian Maia. I'm like, who's the fuck is going for a knee bar on Damian Maia? They scramble back up, they get to the feet. Maia throws a jab. It's not, I don't want to call it a lazy jab, but he throws a jab from the southpaw orthodox stance. Maia southpaw throws a jab. It comes up just shy, just short. Burns leans back just a little bit and comes back with just a quick whipping hook over the top and tags him. No power on it. He says his coach has told him, let's just look for the speed. No power. Comes over the top, clips him, puts Maia down. Maya's head hits the canvas. He doesn't want to follow up. He puts his hands up thinking the fight's over. Walk off KO. The ref does not allow it. He says, keep fucking fighting. He goes in there, goes berserk ape shit with the ground and pound, Donkey Kong status, and the ref finally jumps in. I mean, the strikes weren't like devastating shots because it was just really rapid shots. And obviously, Burns didn't really want to tee off on a guy he looked up to coming up. But it shows you something about Gilbert Burns, and it shows you something about jiu-jitsu. It's like there are levels to BJJ. I always say there are black belts, and then there are black belts. In a matchup like this, I think it was a little disrespectful to what Burns has accomplished in his BJJ career in comparison to Maia. And obviously, Maia is a multiple-time world champion and things like that. But to discredit the body of work that Gilbert Burns has in the jiu-jitsu world, and it showed. It hit the ground. Okay, we're going to do this. Boom, boom, boom. Maia's taking him down with the outside single leg. As soon as the fight hits the ground, he's transitioning under the leg. He's diving under the leg as Maia's taking him down. Elevates him and uses it to sweep to get himself back up to the feet. So again, you can have great BJJ for BJJ. But for MMA, Gilbert Burns was spot on with the things that he did the work for, knowing that going into this fight, Maia's really good at what? Butterfly sweeps, butterfly guard, top position, outside single dumps, body lock for outside reaps and trips. And we obviously know when he gets on your back, it's a fucking problem. But every single position that he was able to get, Burns had an answer. And it's what's fascinating is because I would have thought when Damian Maia fought Ben Askren, that Askren would have given him more problems based on his wrestling background and being able to stifle his game on top. But he was very loosey-goosey, which gave Maia a lot of openings for him to utilize leg attacks and elevate Ben Askren and use those leg attacks to either sweep or reap the leg for submission attempts and not allow Ben Askren to ever get settled or comfortable in any position whatsoever. So kudos to Gilbert Burns. I'm looking forward to see what's going to be happening for him next. I mean, there's Ponce Nibio when he comes back from his injury. There's Leon Edwards, Tyron Woodley. Maybe they're going to rebook that fight since it's not happening in London anymore. Who else is there? Rafael Dos Anjos is there. So there's a lot of big fights for Gilbert Burns. And it's interesting, you know, it's crazy how much weight this guy used to cut to get down to 55. And he still looks huge at 170. So at my 42 years old, I think, I don't know what else is there for him to do. He can always retire, walk away, and keep his jiu-jitsu gyms going. I don't know, after a loss like this, if winning gold is still in his immediate future. He would have to rattle off another 3, possibly 4 wins and maybe have some stars align where guys got hurt, or there's just another opening where a guy he didn't fight is challenging for the belt, and maybe the guy gets hurt and maybe he could jump in there and step in on the short notice opportunity, that type of thing. We all seen crazier things happen. Michael Bisping versus Luke Rockhold. Blessing in disguise. What happened? Fortunes changed for Michael Bisping. UFC champion, defended the belt once against Dan Henderson. So who knows? But I'm not writing him off, but I'm going to say it's very unlikely that he's going to be able to get that opportunity again. But like I said, I've seen crazier things happen. If he's still motivated enough to want to continue training for these training camps, these hard, intensive training camps, and make another run. But at the end of the day, I would think he's made a ton of money. He's got a big enough name. His jiu-jitsu gym, I would imagine, is flourishing. And yeah, Damian Maia, the OG human backpack. Renato Moicano versus Damir Hadzovic. This fight was interesting because of the controversy at the end where these guys were chirping each other. It was weird. I don't know if Hadzovic was talking shit when Renato took him down or something, because as soon as he submitted him, he stood over him. He was saying some shit. I'm just like, what the fuck is going on? Why is he chirping him? Did they have like bad blood or something? I don't know. But it seemed like the only bad blood was Demir saying, if you want to fight more, because that's what Renato said, Moicano said, I want to fight more. And he said, Demir goes, well, you shouldn't have submitted me then. And I'm over here scratching my head like, Bert? I'm like, this motherfucker crazy. Like, I don't get paid to have a barn burner of a fight. If it happens, it happens. But the fact that you let me submit you and you couldn't stop it, that's on you, motherfucker. You got to get the fuck out of there. And this was the debut of Renato Moicano at 155. Instead of him draining his body to get down to 145, I think him draining his body, probably not cutting the weight the right way, probably made it a little bit easier for him to get those knockout losses. Not knockout losses. He did lose to Jose Aldo, TKO. And I think it was more so body shots and then the shots up top. But I think he's more durable. He has more fluid in his brain and things like that. He's more hydrated. So he can take those shots a lot better at 155 as opposed to 145, where he fought Chang Sung Jung. And Chang Sung Jung knocked him out in like, I think less than 2 minutes, maybe even in about a minute of the first round. So big frame. I think he's like 6 feet tall. So I think this is going to be a great weight class for him. He could put on a little bit of size, a little bit more muscle. And I think he's going to have more speed in comparison to some bigger guys who are cutting down. And I'm looking forward to see what's going to be the next matchup for him, because he was a big prospect at 145, ranked number 7. He called out Paul Felder, saying he's ranked number 755. It's weird because people are calling out Paul Felder after he said he wanted to retire. And now Felder's getting all these call-outs, which is interesting. I don't know if people are thinking, let me catch him on the way out type of thing. Maybe he won't be as motivated. But whatever they think it is, Paul Felder is still dangerous out for anybody. Motivated or not, that guy is throwing elbows and he's going to swing them things either way. Johnny Walker versus Nikita Krylov. This fight went the distance. Johnny Walker impressed when he was able to get a sweep on Nikita Krylov and land some big ground and pound damage in that second round. But ultimately, the story of this fight was Nikita Krylov utilizing his ground game and neutralizing the big, strong, heavy hitter, a heavy puncher of Johnny Walker, who just seems to be super explosive and fatigues very quickly. In comparison to, I'm not going to say most lightweights. I think most lightweights generally have the same gas tank. I just think Johnny Walker gets tired a little bit sooner than most. He uses a lot of big actions, as DC likes to call it. Big kicks, jumping knees, flying knees. I guess it's still jumping knees, head kicks, that type of thing. He throws bombs, spinning back fists and stuff like that. So when you use those big actions as a light heavyweight, it requires your body a lot more oxygen to perform those moves and to recover with that lactic acid threshold so that you can bounce back in the fight and you're not just cramping up with all the lactic acid buildup and not cramping up, but becoming more stiff and you're slower in your movements because your body isn't being able to flush out that lactic acid and move it as efficiently as it was in the very beginning of the fight. Francisco Trinaldo, John Medeski. Trinaldo looked good, in my opinion, even though as old as he is, he's still able to hang with these guys. And he said it himself. I don't get it either. A lot of these guys like run away from him. It looks like he hits hard. He commits to those strikes, and I think he's still a very dangerous guy, and that's probably why guys feel so threatened when they get in there with him. But either way, still a top dog in that division, still making money, and at the end of the day, for me, it's all about winning and making money, getting both checks so that you can continue to do what you want to do with your life and set yourself up for your future and your retirement. So I have no problem with it. I don't think he's ever going to fight for UFC gold unless he goes on a ridiculous run. I just don't really see that happening at his age. And with the other guys at that division, lightweight, is just highly impressive. So I just really don't see it happening. And again, I'm not here to write anybody's future and set that in stone. But at that age, we all see how the UFC operates. It's very tough for them to give the older folks title shots unless they're a big, big marquee name. And I just don't see that happening with Trinaldo unless he's going to change some things up and really, really make a run. Other than that, Medeski, I don't know. It was a weird fight. Just used a lot of like point fighting strategy. Very non-committal with his strikes. And I can understand not being non-committal. But if you're not going to use like grappling or something to take the guy down, to ice a round, to win a round, to solidify the round, whatever you want to call it, then it's like, what are we doing? Because it just looks like you're just circling non-stop, like literally non-stop. He did land a couple good strikes, but for the most part, Francisco Trinaldo was running away with that all day long. And I know the commentators were saying the strike count was in favor of Medeski. But I'm like, how? What? The touches don't outweigh the significant strike, which are still just as high as the strikes landed by John Medeski. Now, the next fight, Jussier Formiga versus Brandon Moreno. Moreno comes out with the 3-round decision win. Very interesting fight. I thought Formiga was going to win that fight. I did see Moreno working out at the PI, and he looked good. But for me, I'm a big-time believer in grappling, neutralizing strikers. And that was not the case. I thought Formiga was going to be able to get him down one time, get on his back, maintain control, and either get a submission or, again, just maintain control and win the fight via how he always does, which is he gets people down, gets their back, and he just controls them the whole time. That was not the case with this one. Moreno was able to light him up on the feet. Anytime Formiga had some success getting him down to the mat, one time he had one hook in. It looked like he was about to put the other hook in. Moreno just spins out and just like almost spikes Formiga on his head. And as he's doing that, he shimmies himself out, gets free, ends up on the top position. Beautiful, beautiful, high-level stuff. The one time Formiga had his back on the ground, he was able to shimmy out and cause another scramble and get back to his feet. He did a lot of stuff in there that impressed me. And even when he was in mount for a split second, he was able to reverse and get out of that position based on him not staying still and not allowing Formiga to set up shop in that position to where he could land some ground and pound, set up arm triangle chokes, or even set up arm bars or mounted triangles, anything of that nature whatsoever. So he could not ever really get started with his ground attacks. But credit and kudos to Brandon Moreno, who was super emotional after his win, because I think for himself, he also realized, like, yo, for me to beat a guy like that who's so decorated in the grappling department, who's ranked higher than me, I think it gave him a lot of motivation and I don't even know the word right now. It's on the tip of the tongue. But reinforce that self-belief in himself and his abilities. I'm not sure what's happening with the UFC flyweight division. I know Michael Bisping was trying to get him to kind of call his shot and what he wanted next, him beating Kai Kara-France. So he's up there, man, and essentially could probably be fighting for the belt next, or maybe after the rematch between Davison Figueiredo and Joey Benavidez. That's probably not going to happen until like July, though, after Joey heals up his cuts from the headbutt. That was a big gash in his head and his eyebrow. So we're going to see what happens with that, but I can see Moreno being able to jump in that mix and keep that UFC flyweight division going. Next, strawweights, Amanda Ribas versus Ronda Marcos. Very, very dominant fight from Amanda Ribas, I thought. Marcos, she did the best that she could, but I thought Ribas was just on another level in terms of her striking, her grappling. Marcos did land a beautiful elbow in the clinch. I think it was in the first or halfway through the second round where she framed her and just... she blocked the arm, textbook, and came over with a beautiful right elbow. And I was like, wow, this might change the outcome of the fight, just that one shakeup. Because sometimes one strike is all you need to really command some respect and really get your opponent hesitant in certain positions. But that was not the case, man. Amanda Ribas, after beating Mackenzie Dern, comes out, follows up with another great performance, 9-1 now. And beating a tough girl like Ronda Marcos, who's seasoned, been on the Ultimate Fighter show. And like I said, very, very dominant decision fight for her. The next fight, bantamweight, Rani Yahya versus Enrique Barzola. This fight was a draw. Really fun fight. Barzola really turned it up a notch in that third round, 10-8 round, in my opinion. Arguably, definitely lost the first round, arguably lost the second. Probably a toss-up, very, very close round, being that he was able to do a little bit more damage than Rani Yahya's control time. So it depends on what you're factoring more, the little bit of the few amount of damage strikes. Damaging strikes that Barzola was able to throw in the end, that last like minute and a half of that second round, in comparison to about three and a half minutes of control time from Rani Yahya. So, I'm saying maybe like 3 minutes of control time from Rani Yahya. So, the control time, the scrambles of no damage, and the striking, the ground and pound, and the reversal of the position by Barzola in that second end of the second round, and him dominating that third round, really defines who wins the fight. That 10-8 round was huge. Two judges gave it a 10-8 round, so two judges had it rounds one and two for Yahya. One judge had Barzola winning the fight, and I honestly thought Barzola might have or should have won the fight. Just my opinion. Like I said, I'm big on grappling, but if you control someone and don't do anything, or if you don't have a ton of near submission attempts, it's hard for me to outweigh the damage done by somebody else if you get reversed and end up on your back for the remainder of the round and eat a couple strikes here and there. Not like little pity pat strikes. I'm talking like eat a couple of good strikes. I tend to err on the side of the guy who's doing more damage, because that's what a fucking fist fight is. It's damage. Who is beating up the other guy more? Not who is controlling the other guy more. That is a factor of MMA fighting. But at the end of the day, a fist fight is what we know when we're growing up in elementary school, middle school, high school, and even college. It's fucking damage. That's it. That's how we scored a fight. Who got their ass whipped? So if Barzola started the fight like that, in the second round like that, and then Rani Yahya controlled him for the last 3 minutes of the round, then I tend to be more swayed by what I saw last. Like, almost that beginning of the round almost gets like a wash. it's weird because if it happens the other way, you feel differently about it. And that's why I always say every round, no matter if you start strong and the other guy starts to battle back, always try to finish that round as strong as you can, because I think whatever the judges see last tends to sway their minds and their opinions a lot more than anything else. I mean, for the most part, those are the only fights I was able to watch. I was on a plane the entire time, so I didn't get to watch all of them. I was going to watch the rest, but I'm just like, whatever at this point. Traveling could get you a little burnt out, so it's a little tough. But, man, I'm just trying to figure out what the UFC is going to do with this Tony Ferguson and Khabib fight. I know the next few cards, Portland, UFC in Columbus, Ohio is going to be canceled. And UFC London was canceled as well. So I saw the UFC posting something about the email. Any fighter who's willing to take a short notice fight, bantamweight all the way through welterweight, I believe it was, they were willing to give fights on 6 days notice just to keep the card together. The issue with that is they sign a ton of new talent, right? As they sign a ton of new talent, they now are contractually obligated to get the other fighters who now don't have fights. So within our contracts, there's like I think it's like a 2-fight minimum. Don't quote me word for word, but I believe there's like a certain amount of fights you should get in a year. And I think it's 2 fights and it's within a certain time frame unless you are hurt. So if you are hurt, the lifeline of that contract gets extended based on the amount of time that you're hurt. So if I'm out for 2 months or a year, my contract life gets extended for 2 months to a year. Where if I'm just sitting sideline, they have not gotten me a fight and I did not turn down any fights, contractually, they're obligated to fulfill that. And you'll see where they sometimes matchups just happen because guys just haven't had fights in such a long period of time. I don't know how much that rule is actually enforced, because sometimes I see these guys who haven't had fights in so long, and I wonder if they know about that clause, or maybe it's not, like I said, it's not heavily enforced, so maybe it's not that big of a deal. So I don't really have much say on that or experience in that department, but for the most part, that's usually what they try to do. So I would be fascinated to see how they handle this situation, because now a lot of guys are going to be trying to get squeezed into or jammed onto these other cards. And for me, who's trying to get on the May 16th card, I might get jammed up and backed up where I might have to fight in June by default, which I don't mind, because Texas doesn't have state income tax as well, just like Nevada. So I'm good with that. If I got to fight in Austin, Texas, I'm cool with that, and it gives my body more time to heal. As I told the matchmaker, he asked me, when do I think I'll be back? And I said, listen, I can be back. I could probably fight sooner. But at the end of the day, having more time to heal is always going to be better, especially with a major surgery with the one that I had. And that's pretty much where I stand with everything right now. I did talk about the taxes and stuff. So quick little thing that I learned from my new accountant was, with personal property, now there's a such thing called capital gains tax. So if I buy a house for $100,000 and over 5 years, it appreciates to $150,000, not $150,000 extra. So the new value of the house is now $150,000. So when I go get my appraisal, they come in, oh, congratulations, your house is now worth $150,000. Great. I just made $50,000 on my house without doing anything. That's cool and all. But if I go to sell it, I have $50,000 of capital gains that I'm now going to be taxed on. So whatever that tax bracket is going to be on top of my income. So maybe I'm in the 12% percentile of taxes or 20% that now gets added on top of my income. Or based on if your house is in a S-Corp, LLC, C-Corp, whatever it is. I don't think most people do it in C-Corps, but LLC or S-Corporation. So the difference with personal property. Now, if this is my personal house, what I learned was I do not get taxed on capital gains up to $250,000, which is huge, people. Huge. With that being said, it gave me a little bit of a loophole to figure out with my mom's house. Even though it's still both of my properties and my mom lives there, it's not a rental property because it's my mom's house, you know? So you see, so it's a little bit of a loophole that I get to work with because I have my personal residence that I actually did collect income from, and I can now use my mom's residence as my personal, where I got hammered on all the renovations that I overdid on my mom's house. Being that I can't get the immediate deductions, I could do the 5-year thing and condense it instead of the 27 and a half years for the itemizations of all the stuff that I got done, the windows, the doors, the flooring, the paint, all that shit. So that could help me out in terms of just negating all the issues that I have with that. So I make the house my personal, which is my mom's house. I can go to sell it after, I think, 2 or 3 years. I think you have to live in it 2 out of the 5 years or 3 out of the 5 years, something like that. I have to double check on that. My accountant said he was going to double check on that too. And once you do that, you are now subject to, well, now freely able to sell your house and not be subject to capital gains tax up to the cap of $250K. Excess of that, now you got to start paying some taxes on those dollars, on those dollars. So I'm sitting good with that. I'm trying to run some numbers because I'm potentially going to do a cash out refi. I was talking to Krauss about this because here's my thing. I bought the house. I put down a pretty sizable down payment, but I paid taxes on that money the year before. So that would have been 2018. So I had that money carry over. I used that money to buy the house in 2019. Okay. In my head, I'm shitting bricks because I'm like, well, I don't have money. I'm cash poor right now. I over-renovated. I can't get the benefit of that right now, but I still owe Uncle Sam money. What do I do? What do I do? What do I do? I'm shooting the shit with James Krauss down at the PI Center. He does a little bit of real estate down there, flips. He does some buy and hold rentals. He has a whole system and things in place. He has his gym in place. He has a lot of good things going on with all the money that he's made through fighting. Good for fucking him. He is the fucking man and has done the right thing, and I'm super proud of a guy like that who can make fighting work out for him, where it's super beneficial in terms of an investment and retirement plan for himself. Fighters, I stick with the fighters all day long because we get the short end of the stick when it comes to pay and having the most brutal sport, in my opinion, compared to other sports and getting paid the least as professionals. But whatever. And for as popular as we are. So the correlation of popularity and the pay is just not there. Okay, so we shoot the shit. We talk about it. He says, yo, I did a cash out refi. And he said his payments only went up $100. He pulled out a sizable amount of money. I don't want to go into details about his personal business, but he pulled out a sizable amount of money. He's like, you know, you don't have to pay. I don't think you have to pay taxes on it. I was like, that's good to know. Let me look that up, because I didn't even think about that. And then I looked it up and they said no. So then I asked my accountant, and he said, no, it's equity. It's equity. Capital gains is what your house is worth, what you bought it for versus what it is now worth when you go to sell it. Okay, that makes sense. Now, with the equity, I take out the equity. I can pay Uncle Sam. I can put some more cash to keep me afloat. And I can still make my contribution to my SEP IRA account. And in order to keep my taxes low, so I paid $53K. Last year, end of December, I was told that I'm going to owe another 19. Thousand. That hurts my soul. And I have to make a contribution of 27. Thousand. To my SEP IRA. The only good thing about the SEP IRA is money I get back in the future. Uncle Sam does not give me that money back. I'm not getting a refund. This is just here. Take my monies. So with the money that I'm trying to take out, and it's not that huge, like just roughly 66K, 70K maybe, just so I can have a little money to keep me afloat for the next couple of months, especially with this coronavirus bullshit, people not being able to work. I got to make sure I have myself accountable for that, to keep everything sustainable. I could pay my 27K contribution and I could pay my 19K donation. I'm not even call that a contribution. That's a fucking donation to the government. To Uncle Sam, the IRS. So that works out for me. And yeah. So that's pretty much my situation right now. That was just a little bit of me giving you guys some insight on some of the things I'm trying to do. Maybe that might help some of you guys. Hopefully it does. If not, then it's just, you know, whatever. That's what I'm dealing with. But other than that, I think we're good here. Again, big shout out to my sponsors. Hydrocana, drink Hydrocana, CBD infused oral rehydration. Oral rehydration, the capacity of an IV bag in a shooter or in a packet. Go get them. Go get you some. 25 milligrams of nano CBD. Not regular CBD, nano. Hydration that you can feel on a cellular level. Go check them out. Scientifically proven. Also, my guys at Team Everlast, thank you guys for keeping the podcast afloat and keeping me through these tough times. I'm going to do a little bit of a technique demonstration or technique corner. I was asking people what do they want, grappling or striking. I got pretty much a 50-50 split, so I'm going to do both. I didn't get to ask what technique people wanted to see for grappling, but I'm going to just do something. Actually, I might do another post asking what technique people want to see. Maybe a triangle setup, a get up, or maybe I do like a submission and escape or cage something or something like that. And I'll do like a pole and whichever one is the highest, I'll do that technique for grappling. And if it's striking, I just do whatever the fuck I want to do. And keep it funky, motherfucker. Keep it funky. But again, thank you guys for subscribing, liking my shit, and always tuning in. I'll see you guys next time. And remember, if you like my shit, subscribe to my shit. I'm spinning.
That's the show.
Back fist, baby.
You ain't got to go home, but you got to get to stepping.
We out.
And remember, we bring the noise because the people want the funk. Until next time, this is the Weekly Scraps.